Greg Berg up next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's. 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm Gregory Berg. That music by Felix Mendelssohn, familiar to fans of classical music, is the overture to his incidental music to Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. That play is going to be presented this weekend and the following weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And I'm very excited for part one of today's morning show to have a few minutes to speak with, first of all, Matt Schwader, who is interim guest artist at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, teaching classes there and directing this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which includes a talented cast of students, including Karina Richter and Ryan Zirk, who are respectively a junior and a freshman at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and theater majors there. First of all, warm welcome to all three of you. Glad you made your way through the snow to be with us on the morning show today.
Thank you.
Good to have all of you here.
Good to be here.
So, Matt Schwader, was it your idea to do A Midsummer Night's Dream, or is this just an assignment that just got kind of plopped in your lap?
Well, they were looking for an interim teacher at UW Parkside with the acting program there, and they choose slots for the different sections of the season. And they had talked to me. They said they wanted to do a classical play. They wanted to do a Shakespeare play. They had done a bunch of tragedies and histories lately, and they thought it would be good to do a comedy. Mm. And they hadn't done Midsummer in about 10 years, I believe, maybe longer, more than 10 years. And so I said, why not? We've got a large student body for the show, and even though we have more women than we have men, we finagled the show in a fun way, so there's lots of great roles for women, and decided to go that route, yeah.
Sounds great. I'm curious, with two of our two students here, what your experience with Shakespeare has been up till now. So Karina, for instance, have you done Shakespeare before or this year?
No, I haven't. This is my first one. It's been quite the experience. It's a
I've been working with a great cast. It's been wonderful. Trying to get down the lines and understanding Shakespeare has been a little tough, but working with Matt, it's been much easier than it should have been.
Very good. Yeah. Ryan, how about you? Are you a newcomer to Shakespeare, or are you a grizzled veteran by now?
Generally, I'm familiar with Shakespeare. I only had one class in high school, but no, I've never been in a production that has been Shakespeare. But fortunately, I get to be in one now as my first production at Parkside. I'm really excited because it's directed by Matt Schwader. And, you know, like Karina said, getting down to the nitty-gritty lines and actually understanding what they mean helps you a lot, being able to say it and act it.
Right. I should think. Very, very good. Matt, maybe summarize the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream for those who maybe know the title but really don't understand what the story is about.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to summarize because it's sort of an entangled storyline. We have a group of lovers, two of which want to run away to elope, the other two following them to try and win one another over. At the same time, we've got a couple of royals, a duke and his bride. He won her through battle, and now he's going to win her by wooing. And then once we get into the woods, before we get to the woods, then we have a troop of laborers, basically people who work just regular jobs, but they have a little theater company, a little community theater company, and they're hoping to put on a play for the big wedding at the Duke. That'd be sort of like any community theater in the Midwest going, we're going to take this to Broadway. So they're like really, they think they've got a shot. But they decide to go into the woods to rehearse their play. And once we all get into the woods, there's the king and queen of the fairies, Oberon and Titania, and they are at war over a changeling child. Oberon has a mischievous servant named Puck, and Puck likes to cause problems with people. So Oberon wants to play a trick on his wife, and Puck gets this magic juice from a flower, and when it's put on someone's eyes, the first person, actually the first living thing that they see, doesn't matter if it's a person or not, they fall madly in love with that being. And Puck, of course, puts it on the wrong lover, and madness and mayhem ensue. Puck also transforms the head performer of the community, the community players, into a donkey-headed man so that the queen of the fairies falls in love with him. And that's Bottom, and he has the donkey's head. And then, of course, it's total chaos and running around in the woods and lots of noise and sound and fun. I won't ruin it for you, but things do work out in the end. It's a comedy.
Phew. <Yeah. laughs> Who are these two playing? Karina, who are you?
I play the lovely Hermia. Yes. One of the lovers in the show. Yep.
And is this your other half, in a sense?
Yep, he is. Yep.
So what is your character's name?
Lysander. We've been working on that name for a while.
Yeah, it's good to know who you are and how your own name is pronounced.
Yep.
Very good. You've already touched on the fact that for both of you, this is kind of your first time, your maiden voyage with Shakespeare, aside from sort of just taking it in and understanding what's on the page. What else is challenging then about doing Shakespeare?
Oh, man.
It's pretty physical in this one for you guys.
It's been very physical, yeah.
I mean, a lot of running around, you mean? Or is it...
Oh, well, running
that
around.
Too, but more the intimacy.
Yeah. The intimacy is, it's new for, I think, both of us in a way. And, you know, with Shakespeare, you don't want to play that over-dramatic lover when we're taking it down to a more serious level where it's more real to the world. Like you don't just say, oh, I love you. You say, I love you. You know, that's how we've been doing it.
Right. Really
and it works so much better, and I love it. It's great.
It feels like it's real.
Right.
Yeah, it's easy to fall into the trap of, lovers. And they've done a good job of, I said, play it like heroes. Don't play it like lovers.
Oh.
And they are heroes. They're total heroes.
That's cool. Now, one of the things we should touch on is the fact that this production is in the style known as steampunk.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your decision?
Yeah, it was. The play has some interesting aspects about it. One being that the parent of Hermia, who we have here, and Hermia is here with us now, but the parent of Hermia is demanding death if she does not marry the person that her mother wants her to father in the play, but we changed it to her mother. in our production, doesn't want her to marry. And you have to set that in a time where that makes some sense, where it can be an actual threat that the government would put a child to death because they're not marrying their parent. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose a different time period than the one we're in now. And my attitude was sort of, well, you know, any historic past that we choose is going to be just as arbitrary as a fantasy version, because we'll have to use our imagination to make the play work in there anyway. So there's been this trend of steampunk that's been going on. It's been gaining steam, so to speak, for quite some time. And it started in a sort of literary world, and it's moved over into all the other different arts. There's steampunk music, there's steampunk visual art, and it's something that sort of takes place in the late 1800s. The idea being that it's a mixture of sci-fi and fantasy with a steam-powered world. So you've got, you know, the idea of airships and mechanical men and things like that.
Right. One of the ways for people who don't understand steampunk, I say it's a little bit like if you've ever watched the Wild Wild West, old TV
exactly.
show, because they have all of this technology that in fact didn't exist then, but it's like they move technology ahead just a little bit, but in a way that feels very plausible for the period somehow.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And I don't know that anybody at the time, I'm sure they didn't call that steampunk, but that's kind of what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it's shown up in all kinds of different genres. And so you thought this was a good match.
Yeah, well, you know, it gives us a different, give us a stylish look. It's also a great challenge for our designers. And we have an extraordinary design team at UW Parkside. I think it's one of the best kept secrets of the Kenosha area. We've got a great designer, student designers, Antonio Torres, who's doing our costume designs. And so we've got lots of cool top hats and goggles and strange clothing. And Taylor Varney, who's amazing at hair and makeup, she's going to be doing some stuff too.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. I understand that these two students have a little bit of the play that they can do for us. Give us a little taste of Shakespeare.
Yeah, this is a scene where these two have just decided they're running off to elope in the woods, and they are way ahead of everybody else. They don't think anybody's chasing them, but they've escaped Athens, and they're going to run off and find a place to be. And I guess that's all we need right now. So there you go.
Sounds like fun. Take it away, Karina and Ryan.
Oh, fair love, you faint with wandering in the wood, and to speak troth, I have forgot our way.
What?
Oh, well, rest us, Hermia, if you think it good, and tarry for the comfort of the day.
Oh, be it so, Lysander. Find you out of bed, for I upon this bank will rest my head.
One turf shall serve as pillow for us both. One heart, one bed, two bosoms, one troth.
Oh, nay, good Lysander, for my sake, my dear, lie further off. Do not lie so near.
Oh, take these sense, sweet, of my innocence. Love takes the meaning in love's conference. I mean, but my heart unto yours is knit, so that but one heart we can make of it. Two bosoms interchained at an oath, then two bosoms and a single troth. Then by your side, no bedroom me deny, for lying so, Hermia, I do not lie.
Lysander riddles very prettily. Now much beshrew my manners and my pride if Hermia meant to say Lysander lied. But, good friend, for love and courtesy, lie further off. In human modesty, such separation as may well be said becomes a virtuous bachelor and a maid. So far be distant, and good night, sweet friend, thy love near altar till thy sweet life end.
Amen, amen to that fair prayer, say I, and end life when I end loyalty. Here is my bed. Sleep give thee all his rest.
With half that wish, the wisher's eyes be pressed.
And I wish our listeners could see the beaming smile of pride on the look of Matt Schrader. Obviously really, really pleased with the wonderful work of these two actors. So this is a good little taste of the zest of this play.
Yeah, they've worked really hard. The whole company has, and I couldn't be more proud. I couldn't be more excited.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, Karina, tell us briefly where the acting bug first bit you? I mean, or is this something from as long as you can remember that has been important to you?
Oh, goodness gracious. I've always liked music. I've been in choir since elementary school. I've always done it. My first show, I was in sixth grade, where I decided I'm going to try this out, this acting thing. And I was in ensemble Newsies and did the whole shenanigans. And I decided this is something I really enjoy doing. So I've just stuck with it ever since. And I mean, with going back and forth with majors, I thought, do I want to do this for the rest of my life? And I've really come to terms with it, that this is exactly what I want to do.
Great.
Yeah.
How about you, Ryan?
Well, I've always liked to act in a goofy way, but I was always terrified to be on stage. Absolutely. I couldn't open my mouth to say a line in front of even a small group of people. And up until, like, freshman year of high school, I was just doing technical stuff, like lighting, backstage. I never wanted to be on stage, but I loved being in the classrooms and actually taking the classes. And then my director, Sally Nimzik, kind of inspired me and said, she made me a deal. She was like, Ryan, if you audition senior year, I will guarantee you you'll get the best recommendation from me you ever received from any teacher. I'm like, okay, you know, fine, I'll do it. So I auditioned. And I got the part that I wanted for the play, and then I got the part that I wanted for the musical, both leads, and I was like, wow, I really enjoy this. I actually really enjoy working with a team, being in front of people, and ever since then, it's actually what I wanted to do with my life. So, and Matt Schrader really helped me with that in just the basic acting class at Parkside, and now I just want to pursue that with every fiber of my being. So.
Ah, that's cool. Mm-hmm. So when you were on the wrestling team in high school, you weren't scared of being in front of 1,000 people, but you'd be in front of people as an actor was terrifying.
Yes.
It's like they're two different things.
Two different things. Mostly focus in wrestling. I had great coaches too.
Yeah,
so.
Interesting. Well, we're glad both of you found your way into this production, which sounds like it's going to be an absolute delight.
Yeah.
And you're in the midst of this final week of rehearsals. I imagine there's a lot yet to happen in the next several days.
Yeah, this is the week where all of those technical elements are coming into play, and it's great. We've got Curtis Crump, who's also a student in the music department, and he has composed all the music for us, and that's really fantastic. And like I said, we've got student designers, so now's that last part where the actors, you know, step aside and let the technicians get their work up on the stage, and it's looking amazing. Mm-hmm. Jody Seekus is our set designer, and Jake Bray, as a professional lighting designer as well, has come in, so it's going to look really impressive.
Which theater is this going to be in?
It's on the Main Stage Theater at UW Parkside.
Tell our listeners when and how they should get tickets.
Yeah, so the show runs Friday, March 6th, and Saturday, March 7th, and then again on Thursday, March 12th, Friday the 13th, and Saturday the 14th. All of those will be at 7:30 p.m. And Friday we have a matinee as well at 10 a.m. So Friday the 13th, you could see it at 10 a.m. or 7:30. You can get tickets at the Rita box office. It's called the Rita. It's on UW Parkside. The phone number there is 262-595-2564. And to get to the theater, it's on the south side of the campus. So it's sort of at that intersection where 39th and Highway E, and you just go north on the Avenue of the Arts. It's the building on your right past the sports building. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, so it's an opportunity to experience one of Shakespeare's most delightful plays, and with the intriguing twist of being in the style of steampunk, and with a talented group of actors featuring Karina Richter and Ryan Zirk, two of our guests today, and all under the direction of Matt Schwader. This has been great fun, and we wish you a very successful run of performances of Shakespeare's great masterpiece, and I appreciate you joining us today on this snowy Tuesday morning.
Great to have you. Thank you so much.
I'm Gregory Berg, and part two is coming up in just a moment. Thank you.
stage of the Racine Theater Guild.
I have in hand a book called 50 Ways to Soothe Yourself Without Food. And the title speaks of a very serious problem that just about all of us have. The fact that so many of us tend to put food in our mouths, not out of any sort of actual physical hunger, or not really hunger in the physical sense of the word, but more in the emotional sense of the word. We tend so often to eat the food we eat and the amounts of food we eat for the purpose of self-soothing. And of course, that can lead to absolutely disastrous consequences. And the obesity epidemic, which is sweeping our country, is ample evidence of that. This book, 50 Ways to Soothe Yourself Without Food, explores some of the psychology behind the tendency so many of us have to overeat. And the author, Susan Albers, is a clinical psychologist who has explored this theme and topic thoroughly. She's also the author of Eating Mindfully, Mindfully Eating 101, and Eat, Drink, and Be Mindful. And this book is published by New Harbinger Publications. And Susan Albers, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
I have seen at least one of your previous books, and of course, what is striking is that word mindful that is part of all of the titles. And it seems that that is an abiding theme in your approach to this topic. Just talk for a moment, if you would, about the notion of mindfulness when it comes to eating and how that relates to this specific book.
You're right. Mindfulness is a primary theme in all the books and what I write about, because I really believe that mindless behavior is at the root of a lot of our mindless eating, of our overeating, and if we can turn that around through mindful behavior, we're going to be in much better shape. And what mindfulness is, if you're not familiar with it, is really just having a better awareness of what you're doing. And it may sound simple, but it's trickier than we think, because we can eat an entire plate of food and not taste one bite. I mean, we get into so many habits and so many mindless routines that what we're doing just slips right out of our awareness.
I wonder if this is a subject and concern that you sought out, or if, in a sense, it sought you out through the issues that sort of came walking through your door, the door of your practice. I mean, how did this become such an important mission for you as a clinical psychologist?
You're right. It definitely found me, in that these were the issues that were walking through my door every day. I work with people who have issues with anorexia, bulimia, dieting, all kinds of eating issues. And I was inspired to write this book because so many of my clients would say, you know, I am such a stress eater, or I am such an emotional eater. And they got to the point where they could recognize it, but they didn't know what to do once they got home and they were in the moment. They were standing in front of the refrigerator saying to themselves, I'm stress eating, or I'm about to stress eat. What do I do? So I took a combination of a lot of the different techniques that my clients would talk about that worked for them and looked at the research and put them together to make, you know, a menu of essentially of different options people could do to replace stress eating.
Let's talk for a moment about what it is that draws people to this specific kind of self-soothing. At one point, you characterize it as people trying to find an escape parachute to avoid whatever is bothering them. What are the things about food, about eating, that make it an especially attractive means of self-soothing?
There are so many different reasons people are drawn to food. The first reason is that it's available. It's everywhere. It's within reach. I was at a book signing recently, and a woman approached me, and she said, you know, I didn't really think stress eating was so bad. I mean, no one has ever gotten pulled over, arrested for eating under the influence of Frito-Lay. You know, it's one of those options that people have that is not illegal or dangerous, but becomes dangerous to themselves through their health over time. So it's available option. Also, it works in terms of we wouldn't do it if it didn't feel good to some extent. And it does so because it changes our biochemistry, the neurotransmitters that are working in our body to help us to feel better. But the good news is that there are other techniques that can mimic this same response that your body has to food.
Hmm. I want to explore an interesting list here. It's titled Examples of Self-Soothing with Food. And I thought this was interesting because it sort of takes this apart a little bit. I mean, shows us all kinds of different facets of how food can serve this purpose of relieving stress, of self-soothing. And it's really interesting. I mean, for instance, one of the ways in which eating can do this is that we can eat to stave off boredom. I mean, as someone who is not very often bored, I don't think this is true for me personally, but I think for a lot of people, it probably is. For somebody who is not inclined to pick up and read a book or doesn't enjoy, you know, looking at the world of nature around them or whatever, this might be sort of their stopgap measure to stave off boredom. But what a counterproductive way to do it.
Absolutely. Boredom eating is probably one of the most prevalent issues. Boredom and stress eating and nervous eating are particularly a problem. And why people turn to food to get rid of the boredom is that, you know, it takes time to prepare food, to get it out, and it's entertaining for a while, but it quickly fades, and our attention can only be held for so long by food. It's also distracting. Food is soothing because it distracts us from whatever's going on internally that we're worried about or stressed about. So if you're just focusing on those donuts or the chips or things like that, your mind is focused elsewhere, and it's soothing, again, for a short time. The part that it is tricky is that food is only pleasurable up until a point. And then once you pass that point, we just feel sick and we feel guilty, and it quickly turns from pleasure to displeasure.
Hmm. You characterize people who have this tendency as emotional eaters, but you do make what I think is a worthwhile distinction, that for some people this is something that sort of occurs in spurts, that it's really only in moments of great stress that they tend to do this, that they'll, you know, grab that box of chocolates or whatever the situation might be. And then there are other people for whom this is really a chronic kind of issue. I mean, something which is a problem for them, a terrible temptation, day after day after day, all day long. Do we know what's going on inside those two types that causes that difference? I mean, why for some people is this such a chronic daily issue and for other people just something that rears its head every so often? Do we know the answer to that question?
You're right. There is a difference between this occasional stress eater, and we're all guilty of that from day to day, coming home from work and nibbling on some chocolate after a bad day. And then there's another group of people who maybe fall into the category of binge eating disorder or chronically use food to soothe themselves and really have trouble accessing any other kind of resources that they have to soothe themselves. And the difference, and it's such a complex issue, in some sense maybe biology. And you could compare it to alcohol, issues with alcohol, that there are certain people who are going to have the genetic predisposition to become an alcoholic because their body responds chemically in a certain way to alcohol. And then there are other people who won't. They can drink alcohol and it doesn't have the same effect. And we can compare this to the difference between somebody who's going to become a stress eater and then somebody who is going to chronically use food to soothe and comfort themselves.
There are some people who would tend to be rather judgmental and would say, this is a sign of some kind of character flaw or some kind of weakness of will. I mean, that people just have to be smart enough and courageous enough and wise enough to make the right decisions. I suspect that you would not want people adopting that sort of rhetoric in this discussion.
Yes, I'm glad that we're here to dispel that myth, because you're right. It isn't a personal failure. It is a chronic issue and, in many cases, an illness or a disease that needs treatment from a physician, mental health professional. And those are people who try out some techniques and have a lot of trouble changing them. But the good news is that it is possible. You know, if you're a stress eater who occasionally turns to food, you can do some of these techniques in the book, and I make them very easy and expensive and accessible things that you can do day to day.
One of the striking things, though, in your suggestion on getting started is that you suggest for people who want to make a difference in this area of their lives to begin not by cutting off their comfort eating, but to merely observe it for a time. Why is that helpful versus just cutting off those jelly donuts right from the start? What is gained in that initial phase of self-observation?
Too quickly, we just jump right in there. We decide that we want to change, and we just jump right in before we gather all the information and the facts. And if we take a step back and slow down and just, you're right, I tell my clients exactly that. Don't do anything different from the start. And they're always very relieved by that, and they like that idea. But the reason is because we get a lot from just observing what we're doing. It's kind of like, you know, if you know that someone is watching you, like your boss is in the room, you tend to work a little bit better, and you think about what you're doing. And even if you know that even you're the only person watching, you're going to do a little bit better, and you're going to try a little bit harder and gather more information. And sometimes we try too hard to make changes before we really gather all the information about what we're even doing.
I can think of someone in my life, not really anymore, but someone in my past life, a coworker. I don't want to say too much to give away his or her identity, but I can remember so many times when this person would walk into the room and announce proudly that they had taken themselves off of all sugar. And then that would last for a few days, maybe a week or two, and then they would be, you know, right back to their earlier habits. And then maybe a few weeks later, they would walk in the room and boldly announce something else. And I remember feeling so sad on their behalf, because obviously they had this tremendous desire to try to remove themselves from what had become a rather vicious cycle. But it's as though this is the only model they had at their disposal, was just, you know, to pull the plug on whatever they thought the problem was. And what you suggest in your book is that there are different models, and they might fit different people.
Yes, and I think that's the model that many of us have, that we just have to pull ourselves up from our bootstraps, and we're going to decide, and the next day we're going to take charge of this. And we many of us have a mantra that we go by, you know, I'll start my diet on Monday, and continue to go through that cycle over and over again, that we cross this line and things are going to be different. And instead I say, take away that line. Just give yourself some time, and this is a journey, and, you know, it's going to be a marathon, not little sprints.
Right. Well, and I appreciate the fact that your book outlines the possibility of taking small steps versus the big leap of faith. I mean, that first model works for some people, and the latter works for others. Reminds me of what I hate so much about the television show The Biggest Loser, or whatever they call it. I think they call it something like that. But the thing that bothers me so, maybe more than anything about that show, is that the show seems to be predicated on the idea that everybody essentially is put together the same way. And that all of these overweight people have the same problem, and the same solution is there for all of them. And that solution involves screaming in their face while they're trying to do these back-breaking workouts. And that sort of one-size-fits-all model just angers me so much. And I appreciate about your book that you do not make those kind of blithe blanket assumptions that the same model will work for everyone.
You're right. right. Eating issues are so incredibly complex, and that's why it's so nice to have different models and treatment philosophies and doctors and physicians. And what we don't see so much that goes behind the scenes of the people who are the biggest losers of, you know, what kind of treatment they're getting. We see, you know, 1 hour, one little clip of what they're doing. But, you know, on the show, it seems like essentially what they're all working towards, and I think what everybody is working towards, is this model of eating mindfully, to not go on a diet, to let the dieting go, and to find a way to balance each and every single day what you're eating. You know, and I don't advocate getting rid of all the good foods in your life. I mean, life would be no fun if we didn't have chocolate, if we didn't have, you know, the fun foods that we like, but to eat it in a mindful way.
Just ahead of some of the alternatives to soothing yourself with food, it's probably important for us to outline some differences between what you call emotional hunger and belly hunger. So I guess belly hunger would be, well, you call it true physical hunger versus emotional hunger, which, of course, is something else. I think by now our listeners understand that distinction. Mention one or two of the ways in which we can distinguish between the two in our own lives. Just what kind of a hunger am I feeling at this moment in time?
And it's tricky to distinguish the two. I mean, intellectually, we know the difference, and which I'll mention, the difference between belly hunger and emotional hunger. But boy, when it comes to the day-to-day, sometimes we can genuinely feel hungry and it be this emotional push that is driving us to feel like we're physically hungry and we need something to eat. So the difference is that if you're physically hungry, you're going to have some distinct cues to let you know. So, for example, you've eaten 3 hours ago, or so there's time lag, or that your stomach is rumbling, or you generally know how much you've eaten in a day. Those very distinct physical cues let you know that you are actually really hungry, and it's okay to have a snack. On the other hand, emotional hunger, it's hard to find something to satisfy you, and you don't stop when you're full. Sometimes you want a specific food. I've got to have that chocolate. Nothing else is going to do. And the last part of it is that there's a mindless component to it, that you may not really be enjoying the food that you eat. You're just sort of mechanically eating it as if you're in a trance.
We're speaking with Susan Albers. Her book is 50 Ways to Soothe Yourself Without Food. So really, the balance of your book, then, is exploring all kinds of different ways in which one might satisfy that emotional hunger without putting that Kit Kat or Big Mac or whatever into your mouth, or maybe 2 Big Macs or 10 Kit Kats or whatever the situation might be. You know, I should just relate a little personal story. When I was an adolescent, on my way home from school, essentially every single day, I would stop at Ben Franklin, I would buy 10 Nestle Crunch bars or 10 Kit Kat candy bars, and I would eat them all on the way home. Before I got home, I would have eaten all of that. And fortunately for me, at the time, I had a metabolism where, I mean, I wasn't terribly overweight at all. I was really amazingly slender. But I look back at that behavior now, which I sort of laugh about, but it makes me realize I was obviously not physically hungry for 10 chocolate bars. Mm-hmm. I was emotionally hungry for something, and that was my misguided way of satisfying that need. I didn't have your book at that time, and of course now I have it in hand. There's all kinds of interesting ideas here. The first section is called Mindful Meditation Techniques, and of course that word meditation is probably going to scare off a few people, but you are trying to approach this in a way that probably would be fairly comfortable for a surprisingly large swath of the population who otherwise might not really be much interested in that kind of thing.
Yes, don't let that scare you. All that really means is meditation is finding a way to relax your mind and your body. And here is why these techniques work. Because many people will challenge me and they'll say, you know, food gives me so much pleasure. How can these other things make me feel as good? And what I say is that when you're stress eating, you're really not eating for pleasure. A lot of times you're eating to zone out or to numb out. that food becomes this way of, like I said, that escape parachute to escape your feelings. And what mindfulness does is to help you focus on them and address them instead of running away from them with food, and to make those feelings a lot less scary. So when you're stressed out, your cortisol levels, or the hormones in your body related to stress, they're elevated. So that's when you begin to crave food like sugar and salt and all those comfort foods. And you can naturally bring down those cortisol levels and put them into balance through other relaxation techniques. And the mindfulness meditations are a good example that there's breathing exercises that can lower those cortisol levels naturally so that you can prevent yourself from craving the foods.
You kind of outline several different ways, it looks like 10 different ways in which one might think along the terms of meditation. In another chapter, you talk about changing your thoughts about the way you think about things. For instance, often we eat when we are worried. And so one of your techniques in this section of the book is called Worry Mindfully, in which you give people suggestions on ways in which they might act on their worry besides grabbing food.
Yes, we can all think of times that we're sitting at our desk and worried about something and mindlessly nibbling on crackers or snacks or chips. And instead, you know, we're all going to worry, and we can't get rid of that worry. But what we can do is approach it in a mindful way. So set a time at the end of the day to say, okay, I'm going to take 5 minutes, I'm going to do nothing else than just worry about the issue. And that way, you know, you're not using food as a way to distract yourself from the worry, that you condense it and you mindfully pick a time to approach it. Also in that same section is worry beads, that you can create your own set of these worry beads that keep your hands busy. They're a nice thing to have in your hand to replace food, and it makes you very mindful of when you do reach for food if you have to let go of these. And they've been shown in studies to be calming.
I also like the section right before the worry chapter where you talk about daydreaming the blues away, in which you suggest some ways in which we can, in a slightly more focused fashion, can kind of lose ourselves in some really pleasant daydreams that can also kind of be a nice self-soothing technique.
This is an important one because many mindless eaters or stress eaters find themselves daydreaming about food. They're thinking about what they're going to eat for dinner or what they'd love to have. And in this section, I jump right on that and say, okay, catch yourself. If you're somebody who's daydreaming about food, let's take that out and replace it with lots of different calming, soothing, guided imagery or daydreams that will relax and soothe your body. And these things are very important, these kind of ways of focusing your mind, because nothing can trigger stress eating like your own thoughts. I mean, we have a very powerful opportunity to change the way that we think about food.
Right. And you give us some nuts and bolts techniques on how one might do that, and directing daydreaming in that respect. In another chapter, you're talking about all the ways in which we might soothe ourselves through the senses, and there's things like yoga and working out and even cleaning. And again, you don't just list these, but you talk a bit about how they can be effective in ways we might go about doing it. I think especially helpful in your book is the chapter called Soothing Yourselves with Distractions, in which you come up with all kinds of really interesting ideas here, like making a bucket list. I think a lot of people know what that is. Or a chapter devoted to mini mental challenges. Talk a moment about this. This is such a great idea.
The distractions are important because we have to keep our hands busy and ourselves out of the kitchen, and the more that we distract our mind, the better. There's a study that looks at knitting, for example, and particularly with people who struggle with eating issues. And in this study, they taught people how to knit to keep them distracted. And they found that after surveying the people who struggle with eating issues, that their mind was much more clear and calm. And the reason that this worked is because it's a visual spatial skill. So if you're not a knitter, that's okay. And I list this in my book, other options of visual spatial skills like puzzles and crossword puzzles and things like that, that it keeps your mind distracted. It's hard to eat and do those tasks at the same time. But it also brings you into that same zone that we talked about that people experience when they're sitting in front of the TV trying to zone out. It's this area that they can relax but not be too stressed out, but keep their mind active and occupied because, again, as we said before, boredom triggers eating disorder, like, or eating mindlessly like nothing else.
Right. And by the way, in this list of self-soothing techniques, one of them you suggest is listening to National Public Radio, which, of course, I heartily endorse since we're an NPR affiliate. And then finally, a chapter in which your list of 50 suggestions is rounded out with a number that of suggestions that involve our relationships with others. And I think this is so important, too, because, of course, I think we all are familiar with the scenario in which somebody is alone in their house, alone with their own disappointments and desires and so on. And I think you very rightfully point out that part of what can make such a huge difference is when we are careful to keep ourselves connected with others and with the world around us.
Yes, don't let food be your best friend. When it becomes your best friend, that's a problem. You have to stay connected with other people, and that is so soothing. Nothing is more soothing than a kind or comforting word from someone else. So you can start a blog, or you can read other people's blog. And what's nice about that and different than journaling is that it's interactive. You can get tips and advice from other people. Also, one of the best things that you can do is to get a pet or join with your pet, because what clinical study shows is that pets are very soothing. They help us, you know, they are our companions. You can eat and walk with them. In fact, I had a client recently who came in, and she was really struggling with comfort eating and her weight. And she had, you know, started some counseling to change some of these habits and was using a lot of these techniques, and it was really successful and really working. Well, about 6 months later, she came back in, and she had regained a lot of the weight, and you know, I asked her what happened, and she said that her pet had died. Her companion, she was alone, and she didn't realize how much she had turned to her pet as an alternative and a comforting, soothing companion. They would go for walks together. That would help to get her out and to get exercise, and you know, she would be mindful of what she fed her pet and mindful of what she was eating as well. And so there's a lot of unique ways that people come up with on their own that they may not even be aware are already working for them.
Hmm. And I guess that's part of the whole mindfulness matter, that taking a look at your life, at what works, at what is not working so well, and kind of sorting all this out. By the way, I don't remember if this is mentioned in your book or not, but I wonder if I have a problem with eating at this moment in my life, it's that I eat very, very quickly. I mean, really, really quickly. And I'm wondering, is that something that probably is rooted in self-soothing? Not that everybody eats quickly, but for those of us who do, might that be kind of part of the issue there?
Yes, we all eat on, many of us eat on warp speed, sort of that type A personality of go, go, go. And it can actually feel very uncomfortable for many people to slow down. And, you know, we're often thinking about the next bite and thinking that the next bite is going to make us happy before we even finish the one that we have. We're already thinking, gosh, I want another piece of chocolate before we eat the one that we have. And we have to be very careful as well of the media. The media constantly pushes the therapeutic value of food. The other day I saw an ad for a woman who, she was laying in a bathtub of chocolate. And the subtext, of course, was, you know, don't soothe yourself with a nice, soothing, hot bath, you know, that Calgon take me away approach, but to use food to soothe yourself. So we're constantly fighting these images all around us every single day that say, eat food to feel good.
Hmm. Well, your book gives us 50 alternatives to that, and I can imagine this book being of tremendous help to people. I think it will be for me. The book, again, is titled 50 Ways to Soothe Yourself Without Food. It's not a big book, but it's packed with wonderful information and suggestions. So by no means is it an overwhelming book. I mean, it's a book that anybody can easily take off the shelf and consume and derive benefit from.
And it's the kind that you can throw in your purse and have it at a moment's notice. If you open up the refrigerator, you're out and about, and you really need some help, you can just take it out of your briefcase, your backpack.
The book is published by New Harbinger Publications, the author Susan Albers. Susan Albers, I'm really glad we got to have this conversation. I thank you so much, and I thank you for writing this book.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. The Morning Show is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to